we're recording them. I would defer to you guys, but
our way. We have
recording in progress.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead.
We have three eminent academics who are going to present this afternoon. The first is Philip White, who is assistant professor of history in the Arctic and Northern Studies program at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. The second is Daniel Monteith, who is a professor of anthropology at the University of Alaska Southeast. And then our senior and distinguished Professor Stephen Haycox, the Dean of Alaskan Historians.
My goodness.
I'm giving you, we all depend upon you, Steve, so I have to give you that introduction. And he's Professor Emeritus at UAA. So let's begin with Phil and your presentation. You can go ahead.
Absolutely. Thank you, Bill. And thank you for the to the AHS for hosting us, and especially all the wonderful speakers that we've had in the sessions, both today and last week. I've certainly learned a lot and continue to learn a lot about these important subjects. So today, I'd like to offer somewhat of a contrarian take to be a little bit provocative about the relationship between these two big things, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System and the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. All right. And so a number of different ways that we can dig into this and we can start thinking about it. I suppose the first place to begin is just with an overall conception that this presentation analyzes how the rush to construct the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System TAPS collided with the fight for Native justice. My observation is that for all the excellent scholarship on the Alaska Pipeline and the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, scholars have been somewhat imprecise about the connection between the two events and how they became intertwined. Journalist Mary Clay Berry argues, quote, "There could have never been a Trans-Alaska Pipeline until the question of who owned Alaska was resolved," end quote. Likewise, Alaskan veteran journalist Tim Bradner argues there is, quote, "no question that TAPS would have not been constructed without the passage of ANCSA." So contrary to these ideas, I'd like to argue today that there was nothing inevitable about the Alaska Pipeline precipitating the passage and influencing the character of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. It was not preordained. Scholars have given these events an aura of inevitability that has thin evidence in the historical record. Among scholars, historians have a special duty to be attuned to change over time, and specifically what brought about these changes. And I should also say that historians have a special aversion to this idea of inevitability. We don't like it, right? We want to show how history is contingent, and specifically how change over time occurred. So really important thing to understand at the outset here, oil and native justice were conjoined before the discovery of Prudhoe Bay. But many native leaders joined oil companies and the federal and both federal and state politicians in trying to keep separate the construction of the pipeline from the settlement of native claims. Contrary to many historical accounts, Secretary Udall's land freeze did not directly threaten to derail TAPS. The principals of TAPS, Secretary of the Interior Hickel, and many native leaders and their lawyers worked to advance the settlement of native claims separate from the approval of TAPS, right? And we heard this a little bit before, you know, when Willie Hensley was talking about this delicate walk that they were pursuing, right? They knew Americans wanted the oil, but they wanted to make sure that they were gonna get their the ancestral title to their lands. Ultimately, Native activism, the incompetence of the TAPS consortium, environmental challenges, and serendipity ensured that the pipeline could not proceed without a land claim settlement. oil corporations' urgent need to construct the pipeline turn them into unlikely, and I'd argue temporary, advocates for Native justice. And Alaskans should recognize the precise relationship not only between TAPS spurring ANCSA, but also how the oil industry came to fight for their version, the corporate American version, of Native justice. As part of this process, Native activism also precipitated the dissolution of the TAPS consortium, I'll talk about this, and led to the creation of a new corporate entity to build and operate TAPS, the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, what we all know today. The Native land claims movement, in conjunction with environmental lawsuits, forced a corporate reconfiguration. In turn, TAPS owner companies and interested parties altered the timeline and character of the land claim settlement. Each helped co-produce the other. And ultimately, I think we can make the argument that the engineering of the pipeline went hand in hand with the social engineering of Alaska's First Peoples. According to historian Greg Grandin, the idea that both humanity and the natural world could be perfected through engineering was fundamental to the project of modernity. Grandin has studied how this has occurred in places like South America. So let me start with Act One. We'll call this Before TAPS. Settler politicians connected oil and justice for Alaska Natives before the discovery of Prudhoe Bay or the proposed Alaska pipeline. Two pre-existing elements that would prove instrumental for the Native land claims were the idea that Alaskan oil royalties could provide revenues to compensate First Peoples for their lands. And number two, the idea of creating Native corporations to manage this wealth and resource extraction on Native lands. And this has been talked about in past, in a few of the past sessions, so I won't go into as much depth here as I otherwise would have. But just in terms of thinking about this prehistory, you know, number one, we can say perhaps the first evidence that oil would become a key resource for Native justice stemmed from Richfield's 1957 discovery of oil at Swanson River. In 1964, Congress permitted oil leasings on the Tyonek Reservation. And in the process, the Tyoneks received $12 million in oil lease revenues. The millions brought much needed new infrastructure to the reservation, dozens of new modern homes, new investment properties in Anchorage, as well as new economic and political power for tribal members. Tyonek leadership and funding helped facilitate the creation of AFN in 1966, right? Well-known story here. A year after the creation of AFN, Secretary of the Interior Udall introduced a significant idea that would become influential to ANCSA. In November 1967, Secretary Udall visited Alaska and met with various constituencies, including Alaska Natives. One reason he was in Alaska was to announce oil leasing in the Gulf of Alaska. Several times throughout the trip, Udall suggested revenues from offshore oil and gas might be used to compensate Natives. The Secretary of the Interior knew such a proposal faced serious roadblocks and emphasized, "I'm not making a proposal, I'm tossing out an idea," end quote. So, you know, this brings us to number two, the idea of incorporation. And I absolutely agree with Willie Hensley that the Federal Field Committee for Development, the Fitzgerald Report absolutely popularized the idea of incorporation. And it also popularized the idea of using oil revenues to compensate Alaska Natives for their land claims. The documents that I've seen suggest that the original idea for Native incorporation came from a Fairbanks Stanford-educated lawyer, Barry Jackson, who, you know, I would argue he is the chief architect of the idea of Native incorporation. I would love to hear from other folks on this, if people know an earlier idea. But, you know, Donald Mitchell makes this argument in his book about the Native land claims. And from the documents that I've seen, I generally agree with it. And, you know, Jackson basically saw the corporate structure as a mechanism for First Peoples to overcome the failed, what he perceived as the failed model of reservations in the lower 48. Ironically, he used the Tyonek oil sale as evidence of what could happen. I find that really ironic because, of course, they were on a reservation, right? And so Jackson basically felt strongly that incorporation was the best vehicle for land claims and indigenous self-determination. And then so these two big ideas, oil justice and Native incorporation, become popularized by Fitzgerald's report. And this is all before the discovery of Prudhoe Bay, right? This brings us to Act Two, the pipeline itself. Amidst the North Slope drilling frenzy and efforts to settle native land claims, three of the largest oil companies in the world set about figuring out how to get Alaska's oil to market. In his study of the pipeline, Robert Douglas Mead argues that the oil companies had drawn practically a straight line from Prudhoe Bay to Tidewater as early as April 1968, less than 4 months after the discovery. And quote, from that decision, all else followed. I think Ross Cohen generally agrees with him in his book and, you know, the argument that the pipeline was presumed from day one. And in my readings of this, that's been confirmed. And a lot of what I'm talking about today comes from BP's papers, right? A lot of this stuff is BP's perspective, and this is from the British Petroleum Archives in Warwick, England. So this is one of the preliminary studies that was done by another oil company called Sinclair Oil that BP ended up working with. And this is in 1963 when they said, hey, if we discover on the North Slope, if we discover oil on the North Slope, how are we going to get it to Tidewater? A remarkably prescient vision for what would become the Trans-Alaska pipeline system. And that it's not the purpose of this talk, but I should also say that this route had been scouted by the Navy and by Alaska Native folks doing ground truthing for the Navy as early as the 1940s, right? So in some sense, this was the rutted path. I'm talking about the pipeline here because the decision on how to get the oil to market and how to do that becomes really influential in the entanglement with the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. So why did the principal oil companies commit so quickly to this route and these midstream technologies? The big three selected the pipeline to Valdez because number one, it was the shortest and most direct route. Number two, it offered the most flexibility by being able to utilize the largest oil tankers afloat, 250,000 deadweight tons out of Valdez because it was such a deep water harbor. And number three, because TAP's owners believed they could build it the fastest, speed. This goes into the nature of capitalism. Ultimately, the transportation technologies and the route of the Trans-Alaska pipeline system were decided based upon corporate economics and only later justified to be in the national security, to be in the national security interest, fully mitigating environmental risks and commensurate with native justice. The consortium's plan to construct an 800-mile pipeline across Alaska faced one particularly problematic hangup. Nearly all along the pipeline route, natives were demanding legal title to their ancestral lands. And so the consortium dealt with this problem in two ways. Number one, acting as if Aboriginal title posed no legal challenge to their project. And number two, by mollifying natives along the route with promises of jobs. So what did this look like? On the ground. Well, in one location, we can look at how folks testified before Congress. So in April 1969, the Senate Committee on Interior and Insular Affairs had a hearing, and this really reflects the first tactic of the oil industry, ignoring that that any legal title existed. In testifying about the Senate bill, John Pickering of the Western Oil and Gas Association told Senator Jackson and other senators that the companies he represented, which included the TAP's principals, wanted native land claims settled and all previously issued oil leases to be confirmed. Pickering's testimony contained a, quote, unstated assumption, according to historian Donald Mitchell. Quote, Pickering assumed that the cloud that Aboriginal title imposed would not affect the Secretary of the Interior's authority to issue TAPs the right-of-way permit it needed, end quote. And so while the companies assumed native claims posed no legal challenge to the pipeline, they worked to proactively to mitigate any protest. The month prior to Pickering's testimony, Alaska Senator Mike Gravel set up a meeting between TAPs and AFN. TAPS agreed to give the cash-strapped Native organization a $60,000 contract to, quote, identify and recruit unemployed Alaskans for oil-related jobs, end quote. In June, BP executive J.G. Stainer reported that through Senator Gravel, TAPS was now getting, quote, good cooperation on the Native claims aspect of the problem, end quote. TAPS then moved to mollify Native regional associations along the route. Thomas DeZerga, an ARCO attorney on loan to TAPS, became the consortium's attorney for native land issues. In June, DeZurga met with lawyers and representatives from the Chugach Native Association and three Prince William Sound villages, including their attorney, Stan McCutcheon, and Cecil Barnes, the executive director of the Chugach Native Association. At that meeting, DeZurga began by announcing that TAPS, quote, would not pay 1 cent, end quote, to natives for their land, since it would confirm the notion that native land claims were valid. Instead, DeZurga offered that TAPS would contract the Chugach Native Association, quote, for all services the native people may be qualified and capable to perform, end quote, which included barge services at Valdez. The Chugach Natives extracted commitments from the oil companies to, quote, employ the latest anti-pollution methods for the protection of the fisheries, wildlife, and migratory birds, end quote. In agreement with the Chugach elders, TAPS agreed to use the latest radar, have tankers escorted by tugs, and to provide the natives with jobs as harbor pilots in exchange for land rights, right? This is in 1969. In the years to come, TAPS owner companies ignored or rejected these agreements. These largely forgotten promises would take on a particularly dark salience in the wake of the Exxon Valdez in 1989, as defective radar, lack of tug escorts, and no professional response team all contributed to the disaster. DeZurga and TAPS employed a similar strategy that September at the Tanana Chiefs Conference. According to Tim Wallace and Athabascan, who headed a development corporation created to take advantage of the pipeline, quote, DeZurga stated that natives would be given job preference in pipeline construction work, and a native corporation would be given contracts on a preferential basis if the villages released their claims to the land where the pipeline was going to go, end quote. In a sign of the chicanery to come, DeZurga refused to put that promise in writing, but did offer a letter promising that TAPS would, quote, employ or contract on a non-exclusive basis with the local business community, end quote. Five Athabascan villages along the proposed route waived their Aboriginal claims to federal, waived their Aboriginal claims to for a right of way in exchange for these promises, right? It would soon become apparent that TAPS was interested in native lands, but not native labor or respect. And just as a point of clarification here, when I'm talking about TAPS, you know, this is not Alyeska. This is the organization that preceded Alyeska. The native communities all along the pipeline route, except those a part of the Arctic Slope Native Association, signed right-of-way waivers with TAPS. As the ancestral owners of Prudhoe Bay, the Inupiat of the North Slope remain adamantly opposed to the pipeline and oil development until their claims were settled on fair terms. So they were the only ones who didn't sign a right-of-way of agreement prior to, you know, spring 1970. So what about Udall's land freeze? So, you know, Udall issues his mega land freeze in the so-called super land freeze on January 17th, 1969, just as he's leaving office. My understanding is that this land freeze, withdrew 262 million acres of unreserved public lands from selection under the Alaska Statehood Act, right? So maybe we can have more of a conversation about the idea of Udall's land freeze as this major thing that, that this major block, but I don't necessarily see it. To the extent to which Udall's land freeze helped to advance the settlement, you know, I think it helped to prod the state of Alaska, but I don't think it served as this insurmountable block to the pipeline as many have asserted. Surprisingly, along with Secretary of the Interior Hickel, actors on all sides of the native land claim story tried assiduously to avoid tying the fate of native land claims to the success of the pipeline in the early years. The AFN's white lawyers impressed upon native leaders that they should not interfere with the development of oil, which they saw as paying for justice, right? In congressional testimony to TAPS, no major Native leader or AFN warrior referenced Native claims. Scoop Jackson also considered Native claims not to be an impediment to TAPS. In November 1969, Hickel informed Senator Jackson that permitting the right-of-way to TAPS would in no way be harmful to Native claims. I mean, it's not surprising that he did that, right? But I'm just trying to accumulate the evidence here. The North ASNA, the Arctic Slope Native Association, was the major folks who disagreed with this from day one. So how did oil and justice ultimately get fused here? How did it come to be that, you know, the pipeline, that Native claims blocked the pipeline? In April 1970, the accumulated blunders of the TAPS consortium finally reached a tipping point. In January, the consortium issued letters of intent to subcontractors for the construction of the Hall Road. All of these contracts were with white firms except for one, the firm to do the ice bridge over the Yukon. TAPS managers refused to notify the Athabascan DNH Corporation and other Native organizations of the availability of the contracts. When DNH asked TAPS for information about the contracts like ferry service, TAPS did not even dignify their request with a response, right? When TAPS had, while TAPS had promised employment and contracts, the managers had little intention of actually hiring Native firms or labor. At an October 1969 meeting of TAPS principals in Houston, the oil executives expressed their discontent about giving Natives work simply for political reasons. According to notes taken by BP, management promised jobs to Natives, quote, for the sake of goodwill. But these companies soon began to question even that limited commitment. Quote, few truly Native organizations are equipped to deal with any contracts, end quote. BP's R.E. Watkins summarized in his notes, other than the simple haulage in an efficient manner, which is essential, end quote. At that meeting, TAPS principals communicated their real feelings on the Native issue when they agreed, quote, that the promise to employ Native concerns could only be fulfilled when there was a reasonable confidence of efficient operation and where their tendered price was at least near the economic minimum, end quote. TAPS had offered jobs in exchange for a waiver from the Native tribes, but privately they decided they did not think the Natives had the tools or the skills to do their work, to do the work. Of course, the rest is history. Incensed by TAPS' betrayal, the five Athabascan village councils rescinded their land waivers, and they took it to court. They originally asked Secretary Hickel, do not issue this right of way. Hickel went forward with this, right? This is in March of 1969. Hickel writes a letter to Nixon saying, hey, we're good here. The Natives are taken care of. We're gonna issue this right of way. Stevens Village and the other folks go, they move all the way to court. And, you know, they file their injunction in court. And their attorney was very clear. This is Dan Resnick. And when he, you know, had this case before Judge George Hart, he was very clear that, quote, our clients have never taken the view that they were determined to stop these projects, end quote. Days later, you know, there's also the lawsuit by environmentalists under NEPA, and this totally stalls and halts the whole thing. And I know I'm out of time here, but, you know, basically this is the moment in time in which when these injunctions stop everything, that's what forces the oil companies to go back, and they basically dissolve the TAPS consortium. They said, this has abjectly failed, and they reconceive it as a new corporate mechanism. Ironically, a nonprofit corporate mechanism. Most people don't realize this. Alyeska is a nonprofit operating company. That is a striking foil to the for-profit corporations that they would advocate for, right? And I guess the last thing that I'll say about that is just that, then the oil companies absolutely become these agents of Native land claims and social justice, and they pat themselves on the back in it. And if you read the histories that they talk about, they said, oh, well, we couldn't let this injustice persist. Nonsense. Let's look at the historical record and let's understand proper change over time here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Phil. I will move on now to Daniel and his presentation.
I think we lost Daniel.
Oh my.
Where did he go?
Did we lose you, Dan?
Oh no, there he is. Okay, Dan, you ready to show your video and share your screen?
There I am. Okay. Sorry, I'm trying to get my PowerPoint up here. Give me just a sec. There we go. Can everybody see that?
You can.
And am I coming through loud and clear?
You are.
Awesome. All right. Yake wustini, tlinkit shadnegi, deki na gunana, tleka shadnegi, anyet gusani, aktuasi gugunis chish. It's an honor to be presenting at a conference in which we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. To be presenting with some of the iconic Alaskan Native leaders, Willie Hensley, Sam Kito, Emil Naughty, and Oliver Leavitt, your vision and leadership has created a powerful and lasting legacy for all Alaskan Natives in the state. I'd also like to say I owe a debt of gratitude and recognition to three people down here in Southeast who have joined the ancestors who told me a lot about the Native side of negotiating ANCSA, John Bowbridge, Byron Malott, and another person I don't hear mentioned too often, Robert Willard. William Paul Sr. and his son, Frederick Paul, could be considered two of the most influential Indigenous legal experts and attorneys in the 20th century, even on the national level and arguably maybe on the international level. They both played a significant role in negotiating and lobbying for the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971. Their complex lives and experiences represent and epitomize many generational differences and challenges of Alaska Natives leading up to the signing of ANCSA. Examining their life histories offers many clues about how two Alaska Native leaders and attorneys advocated for the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. William Sr. and Frederick were, I was asked by the Alaska Historical Society just last week, what would you say three things kind of represent both Frederick and William Paul? And I would say they were experts in Native law and expert legal historians about Native law. They were both orators, and they were tireless advocates and activists who were pretty quite skilled lobbyists and labored every day from 1966 for ANCSA until it finally passed on December 18th, 1971.
Dan?
Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but on your PowerPoint, there's a little window that's saying, please move this window away. I don't know what that is, that it's sort of blocking your...
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Can you move that window away? How to get that out of there. Okay.
Yeah, it's messing up my thing.
Okay.
There it goes. Good. I first became familiar with William Paul and Frederick Paul over 30 years ago as I worked with the Tongass tribe on a federal acknowledgement project and worked on my dissertation that would become an ethnohistory of the Tongass tribe. This original research took me to the University of Washington archives, where there's volumes of papers from William Paul Sr. My original research also included a great deal of oral history work, including working with descendants of the Paul family. In this past year, as a cultural anthropologist during a pandemic, I thank William Snyder for finding work for me in the archives and State Historical Library. And in this past year at the State Archives and Historical Library, I've looked at probably over 400 documents from the Paul family. And so I want to today give you a little bit of biographical background about William and Paul and William Paul and Frederick Paul, and some of the things that maybe gave them particular important skills and background and maybe motivated them in certain ways on ANCSA. I'm going to share with you really through their letters, their voice today. William Paul was born in 1885 at the Tontaquan Tlingit village on Tongass Island. William did not grow up knowing his father, Louis Francis Paul, because Louis died just a year after he was born. Louis disappeared, his father, on a trip from Tongass village with Samuel Saxman, a Presbyterian missionary. Saxman was looking for a new site for the mission school and church for the Tontaquan. To speed up on his biography, William did his undergraduate studies at Carlisle. He spent some time also at Whitworth College, and then finally did a year at San Francisco Theological Seminary in San Anselmo, California. He got his law degree by way of correspondence through LaSalle University and received his degree in 1920. And then shortly thereafter, he passed the bar examination, being the first Alaskan to practice law in Alaska. In 1923, he handled his first case in Ketchikan and defended his first clients, who were his mom and Charlie Jones. Don't have a lot of time to go into that, but that was his first legal case. In 1925, William began serving his first term in the Alaska Territorial Legislature. And this is where I really believe he kind of honed a lot of his skills as in terms of lobbying and other things. In 1937, William was disbarred. Well, actually, Bill and Fred, his sons, were off at college at the University of Washington. And then in 1959, after 4 years, each year, successive year, Frederick Paul worked on getting his father's license or getting him restored in terms of the legal bar. And that was granted in 1959. William Lewis Paul died only 6 years after the enactment of ANCSA in 1977. A little bit of autobiographical information about Frederick Paul. Frederick Paul was born in 1914 in Alameda, California. He grew up mostly in Ketchikan in Southeast Alaska. And here's a quote from his autobiography, Then Fight For It. And this is an important quote because I think it really brings to heart the connection to the land. And this is talking about his experiences summertime going to fish camp. To Bill and me, Salmon Bay, our father's ancestral fishing ground, was a dream come true. We had a collie pup named Victor, and the three of us romped up and down the beach and explored up the river and down the river. With a shred of net, we played at being fishermen. What beautiful country is that stretch of land and sea? There I began to know the visceral feeling called by those who know it and love and the love for one's own land. Feeling is, I fear, almost unknown to persons who have grown up in urban settings. This love of the land lies at the heart of the native land claims. It is not an easy concept to explain to urban whites whose ideas of beauty are colored by the bottom line. In 1936, Frederick and Paul, after this childhood of growing up and spending a lot of time in the outdoors and living in Ketchikan, they then went off to the University of Washington. and started their studies there. Eventually, both of them would receive their law degrees at the University of Washington in 1941. At that time, Frederick returned to Ketchikan and lived in Southeast Alaska for a couple few years. He did not fight in World War II because of his poor eyesight. And then by the year 1945, and here I'm going to read from his autobiography again, I decided to return to Seattle. This decision was not a sudden impulse. Since returning to Alaska in 1940, I had felt a sense of oppression growing inside of me. I had studied law as a background for going into business, and I returned to Alaska with the view of using the IRA as a business vehicle. I think this is important because he was also talking about corporations a lot in his letters and negotiating ANCSA. Business, and I'm back to his quote, business organized under the IRA were not required to pay federal, state, or local taxes, an enormous advantage when corporate income taxes stood at roughly 50% of profits. He goes on to say, but the Bureau of Indian Affairs was adamantly opposed to anything the Pauls collectively or individually espoused, and I found it impossible to do business with its officers, the BIA officers. He goes on to say, on this visit to Seattle, I realized, he goes to Seattle in 1945, and he says, on this visit to Seattle, I realized that to become a better lawyer, possibly a great lawyer, I needed stiffer legal competition. He goes on, the quote, and finally, it is a matter of lasting regret that my father never learned how to use my brother and me to help him. He was, of course, a strong-willed man who for more than 20 years had confided in no one and had sought out advice from no one. He had hundreds, perhaps thousands of friends, but none of them was well acquainted with the political processes in Washington, D.C. His habit of consulting only himself could not be overcome by mere sons with who he felt himself to be in some kind of competition. On two occasions, he slighted me in public. At least I was obliged to ask myself some serious questions. If my own people would not employ me, and that's another story for another day, if my own people did not believe in the justice of Aboriginal rights to lands, another discussion for another day. What was I doing in Alaska? For countless reasons of this kind, during the spring of 1945, I decided to leave Alaska and move to Seattle. While he was in Seattle, a few years later, his grandmother, Tilly Paul, wrote him a letter and said, I want to tell you something. I am going to live until we get our land back. She never did. She passed away a few years before the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. I want to jump ahead to when did William Paul and Frederick Paul get involved with the Alaska Native land claims? And as many of you know, there was the letter from Charles Edwardson, Guy Akuk, and Samuel Simmons, who sent a letter to William Paul. And in that letter, they said, we are in the process of organizing a Native association composed of Eskimo people on the northern slope of the Brooks Range in Alaska, with the express intent of securing in court our Aboriginal rights and title to said land. The letter went on to say, this area will run from sea south of Point Hope along a line which follows the Brooks Range divide to the Canadian border and include all the land north to the Arctic Ocean. In the end of the letter, it says, we wish your advice and counsel in the matter and will want you to act as our attorney for the group, starting your fees and any other advice you may give. Yours truly, Charles Edwardson Jr. And that's really what got the relationship going between the William Paul and Frederick Paul and the Arctic North Slope Association. William Paul then immediately upon receipt of the letter sent an affidavit to Barrow for his correspondence to sign, appointing him as their attorney, as he says, attorney in fact. On January 15th, that's when the Arctic Slope, Arctic Native, Arctic Slope Native Association held one of their first big organizational meetings, of course. And in that, that's when there's discussion of appointing William Paul in particular as their native attorney to start the whole process. And it was just a couple days later after the 15th, then on January 18th, that William Paul sent the letter out that said, they, the three above mentioned already, acting for themselves and all the others similarly situated, giving notice to the said governor of Alaska that they claim to be owners of all the land from the 141st meridian to Bristol Bay north of the line. I am executing under power of attorney, duly executed by the said three persons above named, for the inconvenient, for the, excuse me, for the convenience of all parties, take notice that they have entitled themselves as the North Slope Native Association, and that their claim is based on the Aboriginal title by reason of occupation from time immemorial, which title has not been extinguished now or ever. And then, of course, news from 66 to 68 about the potential for oil and discovery of oil. How did Frederick Paul become involved with this operation and actually really took it over? You think about 1966, William Paul Sr. was 81 years old, if I've got my calculations right, and Frederick Paul was 52 years old. And basically there was this visit of after the travels of Perdue, who stopped through on his way north in Seattle and convinced Frederick to work on the case with his father, William Paul. And he said, Frederick at the time, he says, I knew there were still huge areas of Alaska, including most of the North Slope, from which neither Congress nor any body authorized by Congress had taken land for any purposes. I believed I could build a land claims campaign on a solid legal foundation of legal precedent and historical fact. And in his autobiography, he talks about the conversation with Perdue in 66 after these letters and how he got involved then with the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. His wife didn't want him to and thought it would be a long struggle and it would take away from so many family things. William Paul and Frederick Paul were orators in the true Tlingit fashion. They were advocates and orators. And before I get into that, they were activists and advocates. And as soon as Frederick Paul signed on to this, he quickly, on April 12, 1966, sends letters out to 12 different oil companies asserting the rights of his clients, of course, the Arctic Slope Native Association. And in that communication, he says to them, and he wrote 12 different letters to each one of the oil companies, and he starts off, "Dear sirs, please be advised that I am the attorney for the Arctic Slope Native Association, which is a federation of villages of Eskimos on the North Slope of the Brooks Range in Alaska. Please be further advised that the Arctic Slope Native Association is the original owner of the North Slope of the Brooks Range by virtue of original Indian title, sometimes called Aboriginal possession. Your trespass or proposed trespass for oil exploration in that area is therefore an invasion of their rights, invasion of the rights of the owners. I assume that this letter will be referred to your attorneys and may suggest that in their investigation of the legal problems involved, that they search for the statute of the United States, which takes the property of the Indians." So there, in those letters in April of 1966, Frederick Paul, in his 12 letters to the different oil companies, really kind of drops the gauntlet there. William Paul, in particular, was quite the orator, and he knew how to, in a sense, work an audience. And I won't take the time to read his speech. It took him about 2.5 minutes. And it's a famous, very eloquent, very short, about 2-3 minute speech. And there, Congressman Aspinall said, "I've heard Mr. Paul talk several times. I think this is the most eloquent and most succinct statement he ever made." William Paul, in particular, he was in his 80s, and I think played an important role in just his speaking and lobbying back in D.C., and that seems to come out in some of the different documents and communications. Finally, I'd like to end with the relationship between William and Frederick. And I won't go too much into a communication, but I had always kind of assumed that it was kind of a father-son relationship, but didn't know exactly how tight or how strong it was. And that quote I gave you earlier gave you an inkling of kind of, I think William struggled because he maybe didn't have his own, a father of his own. And in 1972, November 27th, 1972, I came across a pretty tough letter from William Paul to Frederick Paul. And it was kind of about settling up lawyer fees and other things after ANCSCA. And I'll just read the conclusion. It says, "In conclusion, I have to say that you have been less than candid with me in this, in other matters. I might have looked at the record in Ketchikan, but it seemed to me as evidence of distrust, a sentiment that I abhor. I think you understand this sentiment and that I abhor it. I think you understand this sentiment because you have sons too." But then he signs it, "Love, William Paul." It's kind of an interesting, revealing picture of they worked together, but yet there was tension under the surface. So in summary, William Paul and Frederick Paul were expert native law attorneys and also experts in native legal history. They were skilled lobbyists, writers, and orators. What impresses me the most about this time period is there's so much of a richness of written documents representing the native voices in the negotiations. As someone who's an anthropologist and ethnohistorian, so often I've relied on oral histories and testimonies. And I think in the future, we might not have the same sort of written record. We'll have to look to emails and other sorts of media. But this is a time period that's well documented in my research by Native voices or letters and communications. And I just wanted to end with, we've had a lot of discussion about the success or not, and Stephen Haycox will go into that. But this is the one of the final lines from Frederick Paul's book. He says, "The government, for the first time in its history, had treated the just grievances of Native citizens with dignity, respect, and consideration." He too saw many of the double binds with the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. But I think that quote kind of epitomizes how he felt it was at least some sort of victory with the federal government. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dan. Next, we'll go to Steve and your presentation.
Dan, you need to stop sharing your screen, please. Oops. Dan, can you stop sharing your screen so then Steve can share his?
Yep.
Thank you.
Sorry, there we go.
And Steve, I think you're muted.
So what else do I need to do?
You have a PowerPoint to show?
I do not.
Okay, then you don't have to do anything else. Just start talking.
Wonderful. Okay. Really appreciate those two papers. They generate a number of comments and questions. This paper is a little bit broader context, but I think relevant to both. Writing in the October 2021 issue of Alaska Magazine, Willie Hensley noted that Alaska Native corporations are an integral part of Alaska's economy. Of the top 40 companies in Alaska measured by revenue, 24 are Alaska Native corporations. Their shareholders, some 138,000, have received about $3 billion in dividends since their inception. They provide $100 million in over 54,000 education scholarships to those shareholders. Many of the corporations operate on a global scale through contracts with the federal government. They employ tens of thousands of people, Native and non-Native. As a result of the claim settlement, Alaska Natives, Hensley wrote, know more about the corporate world than most Americans. Going to annual meetings, reading annual reports, selecting directors, installing management, reviewing and approving budgets, keeping a finger on the pulse of the economy. In the September 16, 2021 edition of the Anchorage Daily News, Anchorage Economic Report publisher Tim Bradner wrote that one need only look around Anchorage at all of the office towers with the names of their Native corporation owners proudly displayed to see how important those corporations are to the Alaska economy. These and numerous other commentaries on the 50th anniversary of the settlement celebrate not just the achievements, but as well the acumen and general capability of Alaska's Native people. And not just their integration into Alaska's economy, but also their contributions to it. By implication, the comments also acclaim the full integration of Alaska Natives into the political and social life of the state. Another implication of such comments is that Alaska society generally, and its non-Native political and social leaders particularly, welcome and similarly celebrate Alaska Native achievements and capability. It's instructive to remember that such was not always the case. This paper directs attention to attitudes about Native capability before AGSA and during the debates on the Act, which stand in stark contrast to today's notions, and thus recognizes the dramatic impact of the settlement, not just on the role of Alaska Natives in Alaska, but on their legitimization in the view of many, many non-Native Alaskans. To establish the pre-ANCSA climate, I begin with Congress's passage of the Tongass Timber Act in 1947. U.S. Forest Service Chief Forester for Alaska in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, B. Frank Heintzelman, Territorial Governor Ernest Greening, and many others had worked for decades to attract timber and pulp companies to invest in development of the Tongass. In the view of these leaders, the passage of the Tlingit-Haida Jurisdictional Act in 1935 and the subsequent filing in the U.S. Court of Claims in 1947 of the Tlingit-Haida claim to all of the land in southeast Alaska greatly complicated their effort. In plain language, they could not imagine that Alaska Natives could be partners and participants in Alaska's economic development and profile and Alaska life, the place that they hold in Alaska today, as described by Mr. Hensley. So they worked very hard to head off any Native control of any land in the Alexander Archipelago in Alaska's panhandle. Confronted with the reality, though, that the court, against all expectation, had the authority to recognize the Native land claim, with their congressional allies, Alaska leaders wrote a bill which hedged against that possibility. It authorized the Forest Service to sell 50-year timber leases and set aside sites for pulp mills. It made no provision for Native land, but it did provide that the proceeds from the timber sales should be put into escrow to be awarded to the Natives should the court decide in their favor. Alaska Native Brotherhood and other Tlingit and Haida leaders testified against the bill, but Congress ignored their protests and passed it. In the aftermath, Greening wrote to Territorial Delegate Bob Bartlett that Alaska had dodged a bullet. Native land ownership, he said, would set back Alaska's development decades, discouraging any potential investment. Territorial leaders labeled the Native land claim immoral, and the legislature resolved against it. Local chambers of commerce decried the possibility of a successful Native land claim. Again, in plain language, Greening and the others viewed Natives as incompetent, disloyal, and, ironically, as potential competitors for the investment money. Two decades later, these same attitudes toward Natives characterized much non-Native thinking about the potentially much more vast land claim being contemplated by the fledgling Alaska Federation of Natives, by Mr. Hensley, and other Native leaders. Mr. Hensley titled his Alaska Magazine article, From Struggle to Strength. The subhead on the piece reads, How Alaska Natives Fought and Won the Land Claims Battle. Against what and or whom did Alaska Natives fight, and why did they have to fight? Mr. Hensley wrote that Alaska politicians and Congress planned to take Native lands, take them with no compensation, and then lease or sell them. At the same time, many urban Alaska politicians, he noted, were annoyed about Alaska Natives having their own tribal governments over which the state had little or no control. The state, including Governor Walter Hickel, did not want Natives to have the land because the Statehood Act authorized the state to to select more than 104 million acres of land for state ownership. By the mid-1960s, the state was firming up its desired selection. Much of the land the state wanted was land to which Alaska Natives had claim based on the disclaimer in the Statehood Act of Alaska's right to any Native claimed land. This became clear to some Alaska leaders when the Public Land Law Review Commission held hearings in Alaska in 1966. The Native claims generated a conflict, a conundrum, which Interior Secretary Stuart Udall placed on hold when he halted conveyances of title to the state so that the Native claims issue could be addressed. The state adamantly but unsuccessfully sought in the courts to eliminate the secretary's land freeze. Discovery of the Prudhoe Bay oil deposit in 1967-68 broke the impasse between Native and state land claims. As Bradner noted in his Daily News column, historian Jack Roderick recorded that Ed Patton, the first president of Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, told the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce, a message intended for all Alaskans, that without the Native claims settlement, there would be no oil pipeline and no oil revenue for Alaska. What would be the nature of a claim settlement? What would its provisions be? Faced with the necessity of a claim settlement, Hickel formed a Native Land Claims Task Force comprised of Natives and non-Natives. Mr. Hensley chaired the task force. It proposed that Alaska Natives gain title to 40 million acres of Alaska land, that they be paid in compensation for relinquishment of that title to the remaining 235 million acres of Alaska, $500 million from the federal treasury, and another $500 million to be paid from a royalty on the development of mineral resources and state land, which of course meant the Prudhoe Bay Oil Project. Governor Hickel accepted the land grant, lands which would be mostly those historically utilized by Natives, as documented in the Federal Field Committee report, Alaska Natives and Land, published in 1968. But Hickel steadfastly opposed the royalty payment from revenue slated to go to the state as taxes and fees on the Prudhoe Bay endeavor or any other development on state land. Other Alaskans joined Hickel in opposing the royalty payments, but many did not accept the land grant, which Hickel agreed to. Many scoffed at it as unacceptable, some on principle, others on the very practical grounds of the money. On analysis, that opposition was based on the same grounds as Ernest Greening's opposition to any land grant to Tlingit and Haida people in the Tongass Timber Act, namely a conviction of the incompetence and disloyalty of Alaska Natives and, ironically, their competition for the money. Emil Nadi was the first president of the Alaska Federation of Natives, formed in 1967. Which took on the formidable task of countering the opposition to the settlement proposed by the task force. Secretary Udall's land freeze was predicated on the idea that Congress would have to solve the claims conundrum. So it was mainly Congress that AFN was going to have to convince. In a Lit Site Alaska interview in 2001, Mr. Nadi discussed the atmosphere in 1968, 69, and 70. "We had a lot of opposition," he said. "Very few people agreed with us. A lot of people in the non-Native community were afraid of land claims. It took a great deal of effort to convince Congress and the administration. We worked with state government trying to get them to support our position. We worked with federal agencies. Most of them did not agree with us." In a 2016 talk in Fairbanks, he elaborated. "We took heat," he said, "criticism, negative editorials, nasty phone calls in the middle of the night. The Alaska State Chamber of Commerce mocked us at an annual meeting. People who were interested in rural development from a non-Native perspective, particularly miners, people who had dreams of homesteading, were worried that all of these proposed rights would cut off entry to mining. There was a strong lobby, and they were influential in persuading businessmen and the more conservative business community to be against this act and against any form of state participation. Both the Alaska Sportsmen's Association and the Alaska Miners Association worked hard in opposition. Both Mr. Hensley and Mr. Noddy have recounted their and other Native leaders' role in building national support for the settlement. They appeared on numerous television programs such as Good Morning America and Johnny Carson. They spoke before countless groups such as the National Council of Churches and the National Congress of American Indians. They wrote editorials for papers such as the New York Times and the Washington Post. A huge assist came from former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg and former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, both of whom appeared with Mr. Noddy when he appeared before a Senate committee. Funding that effort was expensive, as AFN President Mr. Noddy secured a loan from the Tyonic Indian Village and another from the Yakima Indian Tribe in Washington State, as well as contributions from several other Washington and Oregon Indian groups. At one point, Mr. Noddy, expressing his frustration in speaking to a group in Seattle, mused that perhaps the best solution would be the creation of a 51st state for Alaska Natives. When the Settlement Act finally passed Congress in December 1971, many Alaskans experienced an epiphany. The 40 million acre land entitlement was real, and along with it, the nearly $1 billion in capitalization of the Native corporations created by the Act, half of which would indeed come from a royalty on mineral development on state lands. This was the shock and awe of my title. With the reality of the act facing everyone, unhappiness with the prospect of such a settlement was no longer relevant. The business at hand was to accommodate, at least, or to cooperate and nurture, at best. There's a separate paper to be written on the breadth and nature of that reaction, one which I have not yet written, but the introduction to which you are hearing now. I'm not the one to say how successful the integration of Alaska Natives into society and into the Alaska economy has been. Mr. Hensley was quite positive in his article in Alaska Magazine. There's little doubt that Alaska Natives are now seen in a dramatically different light than they were 50 years ago. Some have suggested that given the fact, as Mr. Hensley wrote, that back then Alaska Natives were still primarily living as they had for thousands of years, catching fish, walrus and seals, ducks and geese, belugas and whales, caribou and fur-bearing animals, that Native women were still making winter gear essential for the Native way of life in the icy wilderness, that the negative view of Alaska Natives was in fact warranted then. Most villages had no electricity. People had to haul water from streams or wells, and some still lived in homes made of sod and moved into tents in the summertime. The point I want to make here is that because of those circumstances, many Alaska leaders did not believe Natives were capable of forming and leading corporations, of participating fully in self-government, of competently acquitting themselves of the challenges, opportunities, and responsibilities necessary to manage their lives. This was a prejudice based on appearances, a prejudice which belied analysis. The Alaska Native Brotherhood had been more than competently representing of Alaska Natives for many decades in the 1960s. Natives across Alaska had adapted as needed when given the opportunity to do so. As a noted Stanford University study in 1935 found, Alaska Natives have all the intellectual and emotional capacity of human beings anywhere else, if such validation were in fact needed. As Mr. Hensley implicitly pointed out, the achievements of Alaska Natives in the context of the claim settlement belies any notion of Native incapacity. Roy Hundorf, who was president of Cook Inlet Region Corporation from 1975 to 1996, as well as variously AFN co-chair, chair of the State Chamber of Commerce, and a member of the Board of Alaska Regents. As Hundorf noted at one point in his career, nothing has legitimized Alaska Native people for non-Natives more than the passage of and Alaska Native's successful execution of the provisions of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. In this, as I've tried to suggest, he spoke volumes. So the negative view of Alaska Native capability was a failure of imagination. It was also a manifestation of an easy prejudice. One of the things history measures is change. The legitimization of Alaska Natives in the minds of many non-Native Alaskans wrought by the claims settlement is a change we rightfully, and I hope, gratefully celebrate 50 years on. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Bill, do you want to monitor the chat, or do people have questions? They can put them in the chat.
Yeah, the way I want to proceed is if people would unmute themselves. And Phil, I don't know how soon you need to move, but would you respond to any of the questions in the chat? And we'll give you a couple minutes because I know you need to get to a gate.
Sure. Yeah, a little bit of context for everybody who doesn't know this. So I'm in the Alaskan Embassy right now, which is, of course, the end gate of the Seattle airport. And Bill, the good news is my flight has been delayed. So I've got time to answer any questions. And I don't see any particularly directed at me, but I'm happy to take some.
Yeah, there's at the moment, there's the question would be for Dan, which was, what was William Paul Jr. doing during this period? You were talking about William Sr. and Frederick.
Yeah, great question. And just not enough time to include that in the presentation. Frederick and William Jr., I think, had a few conversations about this, looking at his biography and actually talking to some family members. But he basically opted to keep practicing law, but not get involved with it. And he was down, I believe he was down in Seattle in 66. And Frederick and William had been practicing law together at one point there. A couple years into after 66, of course, William Paul Jr. Joins a bigger law firm that has a famous person in the mountaineering world, James Wickwire, one of the famous climbers who climbed Mount Everest.
All right. And there was a question about, you mentioned Purdue. And, that was
Ron,
and you answered back to him. So it was just, the question was that Ralph Purdue.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I just said Mr. Purdue, or his last name, Ralph Purdue, from the Fairbanks Native Association.
Okay, thank you.
And that was a little bit of tension between Senior and Frederick, was that, he said in that letter in 72, if you're referring to Ralph encouraging you to get involved with this, he wasn't even from the Arctic Slope Native Association.
Okay. Phil, did you have a question for Steve? Was that from you?
Yeah, sorry, it got broken up there in the middle. Steve, I was just hoping that you would talk a little bit about this larger project that you're working on. Certainly this was the introduction. And I'm really curious if you're going to focus on Alaska Natives' perceptions of ANCSA in the early years. When I first heard the title of your talk, that's what I thought it was going to be about. And I'm really fascinated how that compares and contrasts with contemporary criticism of ANCSA from Alaska Natives themselves.
Yeah, sure. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's a big piece of it. Fred Paul, I appreciate, Dan, your closing comment on Fred Paul. He did indeed celebrate the act as at least Congress and political leadership in Alaska and around the country treating natives seriously and civilly, but he despised the act. He said it was he told me in an interview I had with him, it was the greatest land theft in the history of American Indian relations. 235 million acres taken for $1 billion. Duh, we want the land, we don't want the money. So yeah, to answer you, Phil, that's a very big piece of it. Fred worked with Joe Upixin and with Charlie Edwardson, but particularly Joe Upixin on the North Slope. It's a big story, too many particulars to go into, but I appreciate the question because that is a real big piece of the larger story for sure.
Okay.
Steve, I have a question for you. It's more of a statement to you for you to respond to. It seems like this notion of evaluating Native people based on the way in which they were living as a condition in that earlier period, it seems that that goes back to an even earlier period. It has its roots anyway, in terms of the assimilationist era way of ranking people's movement towards citizenship. How were they living? How were they dressing? How well did they handle money? I wondered if you saw that route or whether you disagree with it.
Oh, yeah. No, I think that's really very right on target. Several things have struck me all along in the half century I've been in Alaska and before. And that is natives could do everything that they were supposed to do under the assimilationist program, show up in suits and ties or in beautiful dresses and lovely hats and speak English perfectly and be good Christians and all that, and never be accepted as equal. And I think that is an essential aspect of the way that indigenous people in the United States, indigenous people in Alaska were viewed by the leadership. And that translated then, and this I need to make much more clear, that translated into an assumption, two assumptions. The first assumption is lack of capability. They just don't have it. They'll never be able to be equal because they don't have the capacity to be equal. We can dress them up, but they're never going to be equal, and we won't let them be equal. And then the second one is expressions of Native sovereignty were viewed often as stubbornness, as, oh, these people don't deserve anything because they refuse to cooperate. And they're really stupid because they can't see that by cooperating and by assimilating is their only path to salvation. Mm-hmm. I think that construct was still very much alive in the view of many, many, many people in Alaska in 1971.
Okay.
There's a comment here that apparently Emil is on. He's listening with Tim, I guess. And that Emil notes his proposal back in the day was for a new nation, not a new state.
Corrected. I appreciate that. I understand that. I misspoke. Thank you. Thank you very much, Emil.
And then there's a question from David Ramser. I don't know to whom, but anyway, did any Alaska politicians pay a political price for their support of ANCSA? Seems not. Did President Nixon have to be persuaded to support the Claims Act, or do you think he did so primarily because of the pipeline right-of-way issue? So, Phil, maybe you want to talk about the Nixon and the right-of-way issue. I don't know.
Sure, I can just say a few words about that. My understanding is that, Nixon did need to be persuaded. But he also had, I think again, this goes to Miller's, scholarship on the subject, where Miller showed that, Nixon, I think he had a high school basketball coach who was Native American, and he, it's his thesis that there was a certain sympathy there. But the argument that I would make that I didn't get to in my paper is, the power of these oil companies pushing the Native Claim Settlement Act helped open the doors of the White House for a lot of folks. So I think, you know, we can look at a combination of factors, but, you know, once Alaska Native leaders had more access to the White House, I think that really helped bring Nixon on board. And once Nixon was on board and on board with 40 million acres and $1 billion, that's what really, I don't know, for a lack of a better term, greased the skids of the process and moved it along. Nixon certainly wanted the right of way to happen, but certainly, you know, there was a lot of other complexities in there that he was kind of staying on the sidelines and also trying to still do things like court the environmental movement, as Wally Hickel was. But by 71, he had begun to move away from that, and he was a lot less concerned with environmentalists, and he wanted the pipeline put in place.
Jacqueline has a question for Daniel concerning Frederick Paul. Can you see that in the chat, Dan?
Well, I'm going to read it. Actually, Jacqueline wrote it to everybody. Sometimes people are writing them only to the panelists. So anyway, she wanted to know about the formation of the North Slope Borough. And Fred Paul maintained it was his idea and he wasn't compensated for his work.
Yeah, that's papers that I just recently started to look at at the University of Alaska archives. But the papers I looked at really kind of stop about 1972. And of course, the discussions about the borough were happening during that time frame. So I really can't speak to that a whole lot. I don't know.
Are you talking about the UAA archives?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So that's forthcoming.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of information about that. And Frederick Paul following up on that, feeling he was owed money on that. But I really don't know much of the discussion there. And to me, you know, he may have been the attorney trying to give advice on that, but there were communications back and forth from 66 on with a lot of folks on the Arctic Slope that for him to take credit for it being his idea, you know, I think it was probably a group effort, but to be continued, I'm not sure.
Well, you know, the Eben Hobson is the one given recognition on the North Slope for starting the North Slope Borough. He was certainly the first mayor.
I would think so.
In the local lore up there, he's the name. Frederick Paul's name does not come up, but that doesn't mean Frederick Paul wasn't the one behind the scenes who maybe started it. I don't know that history, but it'd be interesting to know.
Yep.
Let's go to some of the other questions here.
You want me to handle them, Bill? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
A question for Phil. Please elaborate on the significance of TAPS's transformation to Alyeska.
Yeah, thanks for that question, Ron. And this gets a little esoteric, but it's really important because in the early days, you know, TAPS was both the name of the project and the name of the organization, right? And in those days, it was a fairly loose consortium. And there was, you know, different people were on loan to this organization. And it was a very kind of haphazard effort by the oil companies. And the proof is in the pudding, right? Not only in terms of the way that they steamrolled Alaska Natives and offered all these promises that they weren't willing to fulfill, but also in terms of the design of the pipeline, right? They were going to bury 90% of the pipeline. Then it took folks like Art Lackenbrook and the USGS to say, this is a terrible idea and will result, this was Lackenbrook's phrase, in a quote, veritable quagmire. So, you know, as I discussed, it was really the lawsuits that precipitated the transformation into a new company, Alyeska. And we live with those, with the reality of that today. And maybe I'll talk about a few of the implications of that. So one is, this is a centralized company that deals with all communications about the Trans-Alaska pipeline system and its owners. The implication of that is, a lot of folks think Alyeska owns the pipeline. They don't. They're a nonprofit operating company. They built and operated it. So they're kind of this black box for the owner companies, right? We don't actually know what the owner companies are thinking because they have all their squabbles behind closed doors. and then they talk to the public as a unified front. There's, you know, for folks who study the oil industry, you'll know this, oil companies fight like hell behind closed doors. And then when they're out in the public, they're very often unified. One of the other implications of the formation of Alyeska, in addition to kind of the irony of the nonprofit status and they're promoting for-profit native corporations, is also that they they were an undivided joint interest nonprofit operating company. And basically what that means in legal terms is that it gave each owner company more access over the vertical integration, right? These same firms own stakes on the North Slope. They own the tankers, they own the refinery, right? Classic vertical integration. Through the ways that they posted tariffs, they were enabled to basically keep far more of the oil revenues and really handicap the state of Alaska and the state of Alaska's ability to claw back some of those oil rents. So this was a form of corporate organization that enabled them greater leverage over the state of Alaska. And I guess I'll probably leave it there, but you know, this new corporate form was really important, and it came about thanks in part to Native resistance and Native activism in the front of you know, their desire to push this pipeline through Alaska.
Okay, there's another question for you from Lael Morgan in reference to Barry Jackson, and if you've looked into other lawyers besides him, then was he really the one who designed the legislation?
Great, great question, Lael. I appreciate it. And I'd love to have a conversation about this. This is what I've found so far. I've really been fascinated by this idea of like, where did incorporation come from? Dan, I was so, thrilled to hear your presentation. And, you know, Paul absolutely talks about this in Then Fight for It. And that's been an interesting reference as well. I think, this idea that Barry Jackson served on the Fairbanks Native Associations, their cohort of folks who was a part of AFN, and he helped draft, one of the first land claim proposal, it was his argument that, he who does the first draft gets 90% of what they want. This is what Jackson had said. So I'm interested in finding more works from Jackson. Certainly he's no longer alive. Folks, I've heard folks say things about Barry Jackson's character that have nothing to do necessarily with his idea of incorporation. So I think he's a flawed individual. He's an interesting person for us to look at. But I'd love to know if folks have other references about this idea of incorporation, because that's the best thing I've found, but we're always searching for more evidence.
Phil, we do have a recording where Barry Jackson is claiming that he is the father of the corporate solution for land claims. And I can try to search that down for you.
That'd be great. Thanks, Bill.
Okay. And Sue Sheriff responded and said there's in Fred Paul's introduction to his book, it addresses this, but I don't know what this is, if that's the corporation thing or if that's the North Slope Borough thing. Jocelyn Estes adds that Willie mentioned earlier that the idea came from the governor's task force. So you have to see that document that Willie Hensley had, it's the task force report. Phil, Lael Morgan has given you her phone number there. Oh, so Sue was talking about the North Slope Borough origins. So I think those are all I think we've covered all the questions and comments.
Can I just make a comment?
Yeah, go ahead.
Two things. First, Avril Lehrman's question. Bill Paul was associated with Jim Curry in the late 50s and early 60s, and Curry was hounded out of his Alaska Native work, and Bill Paul Jr.'s reputation suffered from that. And then not long after that, Bill Paul Jr. died. So I think that's an important piece. And I just wanted to say, Phil, I really appreciate your work on the relationship between the TAPS and the pipeline and ANCSA. I think the Federal Field Committee report was critical there, and as were, of course, the suits from the villages and then the Environmental Defense Fund and the Wilderness Society. And I think that that gets those two points get really left out of that discussion, as you well pointed out. Thank you very much.
Steve, do you have an answer to the question about did Alaska politicians pay a political price for their support of the Claims Act?
Yeah, well, as Ross Cohen has pointed out, Ernest Greening, for example, in his autobiography, Many Battles, works himself around to taking claim for the Settlement Act, which is sort of interesting. I think there was anxiety, and I'm going to address that in the larger work. Hickel, of course, almost crucified himself in the hearings. And interestingly, one of the reasons that he appointed Ted Stevens was so that Stevens could advise him in the hearings, his hearings for Secretary of the Interior before the Judicial Committee. So I think there was a great deal of anxiety. But I think that being politicians, they understood where to go. That's why I say in my little paper that the time for unhappiness was irrelevant at that point. And I think they figured out very, very quickly, this is a bandwagon we have to get on, and particularly because if we don't get on this bandwagon, it may complicate the right-of-way and the building of the pipeline.
Sheriff adds that Barry Jackson and Jim Thomas discuss land claims on a KUAC radio program, sound recording at UAF. So, yes, at UAF we have a large collection of oral histories and film clips that there's a number of interviews with Barry Jackson. So you could search those and you might find some where he talks about this issue. So it's 5 o'clock. So we are at time. Bill, you have anything else for this group, this session?
No, I think it was a great session, and I appreciate everybody's papers. And I really like the way you built upon the earlier sessions today in your comments. I think that type of incorporation is pretty neat. So thank you very much. And the conference continues tomorrow at 10 a.m.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Recording stopped.
Thank you, everyone.